So, this evening it's my great pleasure to welcome once again to this space, this context, our own Jim Wilson, one of the founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea. Jim has been on his own spiritual quest, a unique spiritual quest, for many years, which has involved his exploration of many different forms of spiritual practice and religious endeavor. He has probably ranged more widely than anyone I can think of off the top of my head. And it says something about the breadth of the human experience with religious and spiritual practice that he can still find something new to devote his considerable talents and energies to, as in tonight's topic about the Quietist's Quest. So I'm looking forward to this talk, and I hope and expect you are too. And welcome, Jim.
Thank you. I'd like to start with, let's see, we'll do 5 to 10 minutes of silent sitting. If you already have a meditation practice, just go into that. The Quietist tradition had an approach, and I'll just briefly touch on that, and that is to settle one's concerns with one's activities in the outside world and turn inward to the silence that is within and the inner light. And the way you do that is, they had several ways of describing it. One is that it's like you're waiting for a guest you've been waiting to see, for you're eager to see this guest. So if impulses arise, you know, like for activity or something like that, when you're waiting for a guest, you don't do them, you know, like because you're waiting for this guest to appear. You'll do them later, you know, like, so if something like that arises, you can have, I'll do it later mind. Just let it slip away, you know, like the guest has always been in the house. So that's kind of secret, you know, like, so if you'd like to try that, we'll try that for about 5 or 10 minutes. In this tradition, you don't have to worry about your body posture. If your back hurts, it's perfectly acceptable to adjust it. Eyes open or closed, either one is acceptable. All right. So let's give that a try. Hi. No, that was great timing. I just hit the bell. I'm going to talk about the Quietists. And the way I'm going to do it is going to tell you a little bit about my own discovery of the Quietist tradition, so you know a little bit about why I became interested in them and where I'm coming from. Then I'm going to tell a little bit about the history and the principal figures. It's good to know about the individuals involved, the characteristics of Quietism, and their basic method. And hopefully we'll have time for what does this tradition have to offer us today? Does it speak to us today? Most of you know that I have a long background in Buddhism. You know, like I studied Buddhism for decades, including periods in Korea and Japan. My journey is kind of complex, but to make that complex story short, I ended up being a pastor at a prison for the criminally insane, like, and while there I had this experience of seeing the presence of, I didn't have a name for it at the time, but what I would call now the inner light of that presence. So my first experience with that sense of an inner light or a divine inner light in people was actually seeing it in other people. I didn't first see it in myself, in other words. And I saw it in people that you wouldn't really expect it. I now interpret that as a grace, because it wasn't something I was looking for or something that I didn't take the job. It was a paid position. I didn't take the job in order to have this experience, or something like that. And that sent me on a trajectory to, the experience was very profound. I began to, in terms of my Buddhist background, the reason I began exploring non-Buddhist traditions was that inner presence was not an emptiness. It was a presence. And so I began to explore other traditions. And again, this period is pretty complicated, but I ended up at a Quaker meeting, and I felt like I put on an old shirt that was 15 years old and fit perfectly. wonderful. And that's where I ended up. The Quakers practice a form of silent prayer and contemplation, so that fit in nicely with my background of practicing a lot of meditation. As I explored the Quaker tradition, I became aware of manuals of Quaker contemplation that the Quaker tradition has, and I stumbled upon a work called A Guide to True Peace. This was a very popular work in the Quaker, among Quakers in the 19th century. The first edition was published in 1813, and it went through numerous editions, and there are still two publishers who distribute it today. Or The Excellency of Inward and Spiritual Prayer, but it is a compilation of much earlier writings. It's a compilation from the Quietist tradition. So that was the connection for me. That led me to I began exploring. There's a period of Quaker history which different historians bracket the time period differently, but roughly 1720 to 1880, something like that. It probably isn't the same everywhere, but which is called the period of quietism in Quaker history. And I became really interested in that period, and everything I got from that period I found inspirational and resonated with my own experience. And I now carry this little booklet with me everywhere because, when I feel off center, I can just open it up and sort of brings me back, brings me back to center. But I began exploring the origins of Quietism. The Quakers and the Quietists arose independently, but they shared very important views. And many of the views that the Quietists expressed were so in resonance with the Quaker tradition that the Quakers adapted a lot of their ideas. The earliest reference I've been able to discover to the Quietists among Quakers was in 1727. So that's a little bit about my own relationship to this tradition. I take a very relaxed approach here. If people have questions or comments, please feel free to raise your hand. Or
you sell the book here, the
pamphlet. A Guide to True Peace. I can get one for you. So see me afterwards.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A little bit about the history of Quietism. It arose in the early 17th century, the early 1600s. The Quaker tradition arose in the mid-1600s in England, so there's an overlap in the appearance of the two traditions. I'm going to make a point. Weaving throughout this, and one of the reasons I want to discuss the Quietists and what happened to them, is that I believe we are the inheritors of what happened in the 17th century in terms of a kind of a deep suspicion of mysticism and inner contemplation arose at that time, and a split between the mystical and the active arose, and it was very stridently and militantly enforced. And I believe that our culture still inherits that, and so one of the purposes of my giving this talk is sort of to become aware of what happened then, because we still think in terms of the severe conflict that arose at that time. Though most of us are not familiar with the particulars, we've inherited that friction,
Is that within a particular church or all churches? Or
I think it's cultural.
Cultural to what? To Europe? Is that?
To Western Europe, America, Australia, that sort of thing. It'll become clearer as I continue. There are a lot of minor authors in the Quietist tradition, but there were three big figures, and the first one was a Spaniard by the name of Miguel de Molinos. He lived from 1628 to 1696. He was a Spanish priest, and I will tell you, one of the really interesting things to me about the Quietists is that they didn't write very much. In contrast with, this is the period right after the Reformation, the Reformation, in a way, is still going on, particularly in England, it's still churning along. And the Reformation leaders tended to write a lot. Think of Luther or Zwingli, they wrote extensive commentaries and theological treatises, and they were defining their position. And the interesting thing about the Quiet, this is the complete works of Miguel de Molinos. It's two books. This is it. This is what he wrote. One of the books is called The Spiritual Guide, and the other is called Frequent Communion. And about this much of the book is introductory material. So that seems to be typical of the Quietists. They wrote a lot of letters. People can be deceived about this because often you will see, particularly with Fenelon, who I will get to, you'll see books, Fenelon on this, or letter, and then they'll have a topic. What the editors have done is they have extracted passages from his letters that have a common theme, and then put them in a book. But he didn't actually write a book on that topic, if you follow me. Molinos taught in the Spiritual Guide. He taught a method of inward prayer, an inward silence, turning inward, and entering into that inward silence to attain union with God, And at first, he was met with huge enthusiasm. He ended up in Italy, at the Vatican, and he had followers among the aristocracy and the high members of the church hierarchy. And he had many assistant teachers, it was a movement, and he was seemed to be, extremely popular. And a backlash ensued, and he was arrested. This was a Jesuit backlash. You know, like, I don't remember the order that Molinos was a member of, but it's probably relevant, you know, like, given church politics at the time, but I can't remember. And he was taken to the Inquisition. Some historians say that he was tortured. Some historians are not quite sure about that, but he was interrogated for a very long time, and then he was marched out and forced to publicly, in a long, humiliating ceremony, publicly forced to recant his heretical doctrine. There is a list of 200-plus errors, you know, like in his teaching, which he had to, you know, read and say, you know, that this was an error. And then he was put into prison, where he died. You know, like, and his movement evaporated. You know, it's like, just Miguel who? And some historians believe that his spiritual guide, more copies of his spiritual guide were burned than any other book in Europe at that time. You know, like, they're consigned to the flames, and, you know, like, just, it was really severe, the backlash was. And when you read it, I mean, one of the things is you're really puzzled about, when you read the spiritual guide, that you don't, it wasn't a call to revolution. He wasn't saying, don't go to church, or the Pope sucks, or, like, or, it's all, it's a very simple manual of instruction about how to quiet the mind, turn inward, and inward silence. And he quotes precedents in Christian mysticism. You know, like, he wants to ground what he's teaching. He doesn't claim any originality. You know, like, he's not saying, I discovered something new. You know, like, it littered through the work are references to previous saints. And some historians are really puzzled, and it's a good question, what was going on at that time that created such a reaction if what he was teaching was something that was identical to what had been taught by previous mystics, going all the way back to my man Dionysus the Areopagite, you know, like maybe 300. You know, like, you can find this kind of teaching about, Dionysus says in his mystical theology that everything which is of the senses, you have to drop everything of the senses as you go into this mystical ascent. It is not something you can see, it is not something you can hear, it is not something you can touch, smell, you know, like, all that. And then in the next section he says, and it is not anything of the mind, it is not anything that you can think of, you know, it is not tall or short or light or dark, or it is not anything that can be thought of, and all that has to be put away. And when you drop all of that, you enter into what he calls a luminous darkness. So there's really, there isn't doctrinally anything that Molinos offers that would conflict with that tradition of Christian mysticism. So, I mean, what happened to him and what happened to his followers, many of his followers were arrested, many of them interrogated. You know, they all, you know, like, said, I don't know who you're talking about, you know, like, and then the cock crowed the 300. So that's the quick story of Molinos' life and passing. And it would seem, you know, like, that would be the end of Quietism. But at the same time, there was a woman by the name of Madame Guyon in France. She lived from 1648 to 1717, so she's 20 years younger than Molinos. You know, like, and so she was, reading her autobiography, she doesn't actually mention Molinos. It would be dangerous to mention Molinos. You know, like, but it's, I think it would be really odd if she wasn't aware of what he was teaching. And she also, here's Madame Guillaume's this is two of her works. And her main work is a short method of prayer. You know, like, and it's, once again, it's a manual of it's a manual that she would give to people. Originally, it was not intended for publication. What she did is she wrote it to give to followers, you know, like, to take home with them, so when they didn't have her around, they would have something to refer to. You know, like, and people urged her to publish it, and she was reluctant to publish it. She felt that the person-to-person contact was an important factor. You know, like, but it began to circulate without her permission. You know, like, and so she decided to publish it.
Yeah. Was she a nun?
No. Oh, thank you for bringing that up. I mean, one of the really interesting things about this group is the variety of their background. Madame Guyon is attractive to me because she was married, had four children, never became a nun, was never ordained, was a laywoman her entire life. And yet she believed that this form of inward prayer was accessible to anyone. To anyone in any walk of life. You know, you did not have to be ordained. You did not have to be, you know, she never preached in formal circumstances, you know, like at a church or at a university, that sort of thing. Usually she taught at people's homes. You know, that was her favored method. Like, she wouldn't rent a hall or something like that. So all her groups were like, the gatherings would be very small. You know, like, she was married at a very early age. I'm sorry, I can't remember how young she was. That wasn't unusual in that time. Her husband was 30 to 35 years older than she was. And, so it was an arranged marriage, you know, like, and she had four children. Because of the difference in age, her husband died when she was still quite young, and she was 34. You know. And she inherited her husband's income and property, and she seems to have been savvy on the monetary material plane, you know, like, she didn't fritter away her money, you know, like, or that sort of thing. She always seemed to, you know, have that base well covered, you know, like. Her first impulse was to do charity work, and I'm not sure why, but she decided Switzerland would be a good reason for charity work. I don't know what was going on in Switzerland at the time, maybe. But, you know, we always think of Switzerland as pretty, you know, pretty wealthy, but I don't know in the 1500s what was happening there. But that didn't last. And eventually she discovered this method of inward prayer. She was searching for a religious life. She thought of joining a community, but that didn't, the pieces didn't come together. And she had children to take care of. And she discovered this method of inward prayer, and that was it. She began instructing other people in that. Word of her teaching spread, and she had followers among the clergy. And eventually her name reached Versailles. This was Louis XIV. The Sun King, and she had aristocratic followers, which is why she would occasionally be at Versailles teaching this method of inward silence. She met Fenelon, who was a bishop, at Versailles. So that's how they crossed paths, and I will get to him later. But it was the most important relationship that either of them had. All right. And just like in Molinos, a reaction followed. There was a bishop of Paris, Bossuet. How would you pronounce that?
Bossuet.
Took an intense disliking to for teaching, you know, like charged her with heresy, and she was she was put on trial three times and imprisoned three times, and the last time she was imprisoned in the Bastille. So it's Bastille Day today. She languished, I think, for 8 years, something like, 1695 to 1702. She's in the Bastille. Through the intercession of a follower at Versailles and the efforts of her children, and she seemed to have remained close to her children her entire life, particularly her oldest son vouched for her, she was finally released and sent to live with her son in southern France. I understand from what I've read that she had to be taken out of the Bastille on a stretcher. So she was released in 1702 and she died in 1717. She continued to teach, even though that was forbidden, through correspondence. I mentioned Fenelon. Fenelon is the third significant or big name in the Quietist movement. He lived from 1651 to 1715. So his life is entirely bracketed by Madame Guyon. Madame Guyon was born in 1648. Fenelon was born in 1651. And he died in 1715. And Madame Guyon died in 1717. So they were precise contemporaries. Fenelon was raised in an aristocratic family, minor aristocracy, but an aristocratic family, and he was designated as the son who would go into the church, which wasn't unusual for aristocratic families at the time. They wanted, a representative of their family in that power system, And he at first achieved fame through writing books on pedagogy. And he wrote a book called Telemachus, which became hugely popular at that time. It's a book on pedagogy, education. And in fact, Thomas Jefferson had a copy of Telemachus on his shelf and thought very highly of it. So even in the colonies, it was well known, very influential on education. And he wrote a book on the education of girls, which he thought was a good idea. But nothing of a religious nature. And then he met Madame Guyon at Versailles, and his life changed. He was on a fast track to maybe being a cardinal, something like that. I mean, he had really risen. He was very learned, of the three big names, he was the most learned, had the most academic background. But she completely transformed his perspective, and he became a follower of hers, which was very unusual in that day. For a man in a position of power, in a structure like that, to publicly follow a lay woman who was not ordained, that sort of thing. Very unusual relationship, And he was, but he was utterly loyal to her, When Madame Guyon was first attacked by Bossuet, Fenelon came to her defense. And he wrote a book called Maxims of the Saints, and it was a defense of the point of view of inward quiet and stillness by quoting predecessors, showing that what was being taught was not, heretical. And so they arrested him. So that was their response. I like to, of the three of them, I have this image of Fenelon at the Inquisition. He wasn't held very long, and reading between the lines, I can see him in this very French way going, "Did I say that? Oh, that's terrible! That's awful!" Sort of, you know, just agreeing with them. You know, whenever they raised a point, he wouldn't argue with them. He'd say, "Well, of course you're right. You know, like, I mean, I couldn't have meant that. That's, you know, like, that's, you know, I don't know how I could have been so careless." You know, like, that was his approach, you know, like, to handling what was a very difficult situation. He was exiled, kicked out of Paris, forbidden to enter Paris at all, or Versailles, to a town called Cambrai in northwest France, later made famous by Marcel Proust in that great big novel of his,
Remembrance
of Things Past. A lot of the action in that novel takes place in Cambrai. So Fenelon continued teaching, but again by correspondence. You know, like, he was forbidden to publish anything or to write anything. So everything he did was by correspondence. So here you have these three people. I mean, it really looks like the Quietism movement is, you know, crushed, hammered, eliminated. You know, like, that certainly was the desire of those who opposed it. You know, like, so. But the Quietist teachings found a ready soil in the Protestant world. Now, like, what's interesting about this is that if the Catholic Church had recognized them, say, as great teachers, the Protestants wouldn't have been interested in them at all. But because they were called heretics and vilified, they said, "Well, yeah, you know, like, we're heretics and vilified, but also, so, you know, like, that'll work." You know, for example, John Wesley had a very high opinion of Guyon and acknowledged her influence on his thought. You know, like, particularly in Wesley's conception of what it means to be holy. That holy is primarily an inward experience, you know, rather than an outward, rather than marked by specific outward signs. You know, like, and then there are the Quakers. You know, like, so many of the doctrines of the Quietists and the Quakers are recognizably similar. The Quaker view is that every human being has the light of God within them. There's a light that is shining since the whole world began. There's a light that is shining in the heart of man. There's a light that is shining in the Turk and the Jew. There's a light that is shining in me and you. And the purpose of silent prayer in the Quaker tradition is to become aware of that divine presence. So you can see the resonance there. And the Quakers quickly felt a strong relationship between the two. The third group that was heavily influenced by the Quietists were a group in Germany called the Pietists. So all these labels, yeah, sorry about that, but the founder of German Pietism was Philip Spener. And he actually translated some Quietist works into German from the French. You know, like, so there's a direct connection. I'm not going to talk much about the Pietists. You know, like, this historical story, if you're historically minded and you're interested in it's quite complicated, but a book was published last year called Experimental Theology in America, Madame Guyon, Fenelon, and Their Readers. But as a prelude to that, the author talks about the various strands of influence in Europe. But it is interesting that Guyon's and Fenelon, in particular, their writings came over to America very quickly. Very quickly. You know, like, they were published. So here's a question. What was going on? What was it that they were teaching? You know, like, so here's an example. So this section is section one of A Guide to True Peace. The Spirit of God dwells in the heart of man. So, we must retire from all outward objects and silence all the desires and wandering imaginations of the mind. That in this profound silence of the whole soul, we may hearken to the ineffable voice of the divine teacher. We must listen with an attentive ear, for it is a still, small voice. It is not indeed a voice uttered in words, as when a man speaks to his friend, but it is a perception infused by the secret operations and influences of the divine spirit, insinuating to us obedience, patience, meekness, humility, and all the other Christian virtues in a language perfectly intelligible to the attentive soul. So that's a very good summary of the quietist method. You know, like, we must retire from all outward objects and silence all the desires and wandering imaginations of the mind. That in this profound silence of the whole soul, we may hearken to the ineffable voice of the divine teacher. And it is a voice. The voice is a metaphor here, because that's followed up by, it's not like a friend speaking to you in words. It's explicitly beyond words. You know, like, so you turn to that divine presence. And that's it. That's their contemplation. So what's the big deal? Anybody have an idea? I have some ideas.
It doesn't require any intermediation.
That's right. Exactly. So here's the picture. You have the Reformation. It's hard for us to get into the psychic space of the Reformation and the immediate post-Reformation period. But, you know, like, the Reformation was kind of a fury. You know, like, I mean, people were just, you know, like, totally committed to their interpretation of the divine. And they were perfectly willing to kill you, you know, like, if you did not agree with that interpretation. You know, like, and not only were they willing to, they regarded it as their duty. You know, like, and, you know, Europe was awash with cities that had been devastated by these kind of religious conflicts. You know, like, I can't remember the 30 Years' War in Germany. Like, there were whole towns which were just virtually decimated, you know, like, during this period. You know, the Lutherans would take over, and then the Catholics would take over, and the Anabaptists would take over, and then the Lutherans would come back, and, you know, like, that kind of thing. But a similar thing kind of happened in England in the next decades. You know, like, so the Catholics were kicked out, and then the Anglicans took over, and then the Puritans took over, and then there were various groups, you know, duking it out for, you know, like, for power. And from one year to the next, you didn't quite know what dogma you had to believe in order to survive. So here's the second characteristic of the quietists at that time. They weren't interested in theology. They didn't write theology. Madame Guénon, Molinos, Fenelon, you will look in vain for theological treatises. So, like, the Quakers are very similar. There are works of theology in the Quaker tradition. The most famous one is Berkeley's Apology for the True Christian Divinity, which is a wonderful work, incidentally. You know, theological treatises go, it's very spacious. So, like, but it is written in that scholastic style, you know, proposition, objection, conclusion, deduction, you know, like that. I don't know if you're familiar with that style, but it's a style that which is very prevalent at that time. Other than that, I can't think of a Quaker theological work. You know, when I say theology, I mean systematic theology. So, like, Quakers tended to write journals, you know, diaries, you know, like the Journal of George Fox, you know, like that sort of this, or, you know, the story of my religious labors and experiences among, you know, this region or that region. And that's what inspired the Quaker tradition. The Pietists also were explicitly discouraged by theology. You know, like, so one of the things I feel is what was happening at that time was a kind of wave of disgust with what had happened. You know, like, here these people were trying to hammer out a doctrine by reason. You know, like, and look what the result was. You know? Well, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't pretty. It wasn't something you'd want to sign on to. You know, like, and besides, you know, like, if you do sign on to it next year, like, that one might be the wrong one, and your signature might, you know, take you to a bad place. Right? So there was this kind of feeling, I think, among the Quietists and the groups they influenced or were similar to, that this is not the direction we want to go. This isn't where spirit dwells. No, this isn't where spirit. You know, theology needs to be the handmaid of that experience, you know, like, rather than the ruler. The ruler. The Pietists in Germany were interesting. They survived. They didn't get imprisoned or that sort of thing, but they were very careful, and I think Spener learned consciously from the experience of the Quietists. They were very careful to go to church every Sunday. You know, like, they did not compete. They did not form a separate sect. You know, like, what they did is they held their groups of silent contemplation on some other day of the week. You know, like, so that, you know, they'd be... Even so, they were met with a huge amount of suspicion because some of the Pietist works... I want to put on a German accent here. Is this is... Oh, yes, give me another theological proposition. 26.1, paragraph C, you know, like, and that will prove what? You know, like, this, you know, like, in this, you know, like, some of the pamphlets the Pietists put out had that tone of open contempt, you know, like, for theological debate. You know, like, so that, and I think that... I think in some ways we are inheritors of this split, you know, this split between the rational mind and the way of the heart. I think we are still the inheritors of that, you know, like, so, you know, people who have that inward experience didn't want to go the way of reason, you know, like, and the idea of integrating the two, I think, was difficult at that time to pull off, you know, like, or... Yeah.
Also, that it was considered reason.
In other words, right. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. When we, from the perspective of the 21st century, look back on some of the disputes of that time, I mean, some of us feel baffled. Like, people got into huge battles, and I'm not using the word metaphorically. They got into huge battles over if you were baptized as an infant or an adult, and whether you were sprinkled or fully immersed, and various combinations of that. You know, like, I mean, you could lose your home, you know, like, be kicked out of your country, or worse, over the position about that issue. You know, like, and so, you know, like, if you have what I call heart wisdom, it's difficult to go along with that kind of thing. So you have a diminution among the Quietists of an interest in outward forms, and that resonates with the Quakers as well. You know, you go to a Quaker meeting house, there's no altar, no cross, no stained glass windows, no, there's benches. And that's about it. People may bring the Bible with them, but there's no, what do you call it, podium, you know, like, or something like that where the Bible is displayed. So, like, part of that song I was quoting, about George Fox. There's a verse that says, "Will you swear on the Bible?" "No, I won't," said he, "for the truth is more holy than a book to me. For the book, it will crumble, and the steeple will fall, but the light will be shining at the end of it all."
And how are these folks differentiated, or how early were they differentiating, or being accepted, or left out in the colonies with all of the various, you're sent into the forest if you don't go along with this creed. You're sent to Rhode Island, or you were left
right.
to go to this other place because this is too strict or too liberal.
You know, I wish I knew more about colonial history.
Yeah.
The only story I can tell you that illustrates the process that was going on in the colonies is the story of Mary Dyer. Who was a Quaker in Boston, and Boston was a Puritan city mm-hmm. at the time.
Mm-hmm.
What are Mary Dyer's dates? Do you remember? Okay. I can't remember either, but 1600s.
Late
1600s. Do you know her story? Or,
no, I don't.
She was a Quaker woman, and she was kicked out of Boston for heretical mm-hmm. Views, and she insisted on coming back, and then she was kicked out again, and she, this process went on, I don't know how many times, 3, 4, 5 times,
So she became like Anne Hathaway of her time.
Yeah, and they finally told her that if she came back, she would be executed, and she came back, and she had what in the Quaker tradition was called a leading, that this was necessary for her to do this, to bring the presence of the light to that inward silence, that inward light, that it was her duty to do that. She wasn't alone. She had two companions, and they did execute her mm-hmm. along with her companions. And there is a statue of her now in Boston Commons of Mary Dyer. She, by all accounts, she went to her death peacefully and completely serenely, and within the year, the governor of Massachusetts colony was so embarrassed by the whole episode that there was a toleration act passed, and she's like a martyr for freedom of religion, She had that impact, So those kinds of things were happening in the colony. So, the question I want to propose to you, though, is the Quietists were hammered. The Quakers in England, the first few generations, were arrested by the thousands. You could be arrested for sitting in a room with others in silence. A criminal offense.
in a way, I think it's not. It's surprising to us because we're looking back at something we don't know. But it's like, if you say, turn into the silence and allow your heart to teach you who you are, right? You don't need that priest, like you were saying. You don't need anything. You're going into something that's there in every person that's ever walked the face of the earth. Anyone. And it's in the silence. And the opposite side to that is what happened when the evangelical movement crashed into the Quakers in the 1800s. And that's where the evangelicals were saying, no, if you quiet yourself and empty yourself, you're simply making space for Satan to come in
yes.
and take you over.
Yes. That's right. And that was a charge against the Quietists at that time, that what would prevent Satan from moving into that silence? You have to have the forms, you have to have the, you have to have the fortress of the form to protect you from that evil.
Isn't there a little validity to that question?
Yeah, there is.
It's
a valid question. And the for me, the response to that is that in the manuals, they do discuss what to do with the arising of like negative thoughts and negative emotions. You know, they do talk about that. They were not naive about the human mind or, you know, those kinds of things appearing. You know, like, and they talk about periods of dryness or when you're overwhelmed. You know, with Madame Guyon is particularly articulate about that. You know, like, but some of the early Quaker tradition talks about that. In the Quaker tradition, the cushion was that if you felt you had a leading from the inner life, you were to take it to the community for what was called discernment. So precisely to deflect the kind of self-delusion, you know, like that might arise. You know, like, so, you know, like, and then the community would, I read an example. This is actually a very common example. Suppose you have a calling to spread a certain idea among the Quaker community. You know, it's called a traveling minister. You know, like, so you would present that to your community, your Quaker community, and say, I've had this leading. I think everyone should know about this. You know, like, and then they would say, the process of discernment could go on for months, I guess even years at times. You know, like, as people went back and forth, and this would get time for this discernment to cook. You know, like, and so in the Quaker tradition, that was the process to handle, you know, like that kind of. So John Woolman is a famous example of that. You know, like, he had an experience where he was convinced that slavery was wrong, and he wanted to take that. But he went to his Quaker community, you know, like, for discernment, and they gave him what is called a minute of travel or something like that. Anyway, it was an authorization that, you know, like, our community has discerned this, we agree with him, you know, like, and we're sending him on his way. You know, like, so that was the mechanism among the Quakers. Yeah?
I'm just taking it for granted that when you're talking about these Quakers, that they are Christians and they believe in the divinity of Christ.
Yes. Yeah. modern Quakers.
In that era they would have? Or
yes.
Wouldn't have?
They would have.
It would have.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So where do they put Christ if they're not real strict on the theology? Where does he put? Where do they?
Christ
put
is the Spirit. Christ is. So, for example, in John the Baptist said, I have come to baptize you with water, but there is one who will come who will baptize you with fire and the Spirit. Okay. So Christ is a spirit. He's not a physical being, you know, like, or primarily a historical being. Christ is the presence of that inner light.
So this would be why they would kill them. Because this would be why these people would be put to death, because they are really going against primary paradigm.
Okay. Yeah. I see. Yeah.
I really think that you have to bear in mind too that church and state were very closely intertwined then. And look at the idea of the divine right of kings. If you're saying that there's no intermediation and no necessity for a hierarchy, that undercuts the whole idea of the monarchy. And they were all monarchies at that time.
That's true.
Right.
Except for Cromwell. The brief period.
Well, turned to monarchy.
So Cromwell became the virtual monarch. You know, like, so I want to talk a little bit about what do we mean by that inner silence or that inner light? You know, like, this, you know, quietism is called a mystical path, and I just want to. This is Jim speaking here now, but what I would like to suggest for consideration is that experience, that inward experience, what you're experiencing is the presence of eternity in the ephemeral individual. Why turn inward? What's the rationale for doing that? Why move away from the world of sensory experience into the inward? And why remove yourself from the rising thoughts and emotions, and that sort of thing? Because all of this is impermanent. All of this will pass away. As Ecclesiastes said, vanity of vanities. And he's very eloquent. If you really want to understand impermanence, Ecclesiastes is your man. He got that. I have tried power, I tried wealth, I tried this, I tried that, and it is all vanity. It is dust in the wind. All of it. But there is that which does not appear or disappear. It's not subject to birth and death. It is the one clear thing. And that can be found by turning inward. And that is the source of true peace. The reason I bring that up in this world at this time, when we live in such an activist culture, it's like when we're in distress, what do? We turn on the TV, put on some music, go on the internet, put on a CD, listen to some music, call a friend, go to a movie, eat something. the idea of turning inward really runs against the impulses that are cultivated at this time. Mm-hmm. It really, really is not, what our culture supports. I can't go to the meeting today because I got to turn inward. Oh, okay, that's a good idea. But it's worth considering. The reason I want to be explicit about the rationale, it's interesting when you read the Quietists, they are not explicit about the rationale about turning inward. They tell you how to do it. It's how-to stuff. They wrote how-to stuff. But they don't tell you why that's a good idea. The rationale. But I think at this time and place, we need that sort of information. What is going on? Because it doesn't make sense to us. Turning inward doesn't make sense to us. That view is not culturally at large.
Barclay, in his seventh proposition, he points out that if we mind the light, we will grow. And we will feel more whole and good and happy. Life will mean more to us. We will find ourselves. And if we ignore the light, we damage ourselves. And eventually we can stamp ourselves out entirely.
Yeah.
George Fox comes up with one to a person who came to him and said, "Oh my God, look, people are running around slaughtering each other, society's falling apart." And he comes back with a focus for how to turn on inward that I love, which goes, "Do not always look down at the darkness and corruption that surround you. Rather, look at the light which has uncovered them to you. Mm-hmm. For if you look down at the darkness and corruption, you will be swallowed up by it. But if you look at the light which uncovered it, you will see over it. And there is your first step to peace. That is where you will find your salvation." Not a mention about Christ.
Thank you. One second. I recently was reading a work from the Quietist tradition where they said when you are beset, they call it besetments. When you have besetments, in your silence. I love that word. I want to revive that word. I think it's a great word. When you have the setbacks, just look over their shoulder. I like that. It's like you don't kick them out. You don't try and stamp them or get rid of them. Just It's kind of like, you know, like if you're at the at some holiday party and the person is talking and you're not particularly interested, you kind of look over the shoulder. You know, like, it's kind of like that. So, talk to
them. Well, this kind of brings me back to how you started your talk about your experience in the prison, and you saw the inner life of people. So I was curious, what things did you see that made you think, oh, there's an inner life here?
Well, it's difficult. But for example, I'll give you one example. One inmate assisted another inmate who had trouble getting into a chair. And I saw that and I said, well, where did that come from? I mean, knowing the history, which I'm not at liberty to go into, it's not something that you would expect that individual to do.
Right.
In a very ordinary, and I said, that was, you know, like that was, and then I, in a way that's really hard to explain, it's like I saw the light in them, you know, which for a brief moment opened in them. You know, in that moment it opened in them. I'm not talking like a bolt of lightning or, you know, like your head was opening up. But it was just like I suddenly became aware that that there was the seed of goodness in them, you know, like that it was present. And then I began to really see it, you know, like, and it was wonderful, but it was also baffling, you know, like.
Because you have been taught that the light is outside and not.
No, it. It was something unexpected. It wasn't that it conflicted with the specific teaching I had. It just, I hadn't had that experience before. So I think it is time to bring this to a close. The last thing I wanted to mention was what quietism has to offer us today. You know, like. And I think what quietism has to offer us today is two things. One is knowing the history of what happened to the quietists has helped me understand our present situation in terms of spirituality and some of the dichotomies that are so strong in our own culture. Mm-hmm. Like I think the seed for those dichotomies was planted at that time. Like and we're still immersed in those dichotomies. We still haven't gotten over that. Right? But second of all, I think the method of the quietists really has something to recommend it. You know, one of the interesting things about the quietists, Madame Guyon says, it's available to everyone. Of course, you don't need a priest, right? You don't need. It's available to everyone. Now that was something new that was introduced into the Western world. The Quakers had the same view. You know, like if you read The Cloud of Unknowing, a famous manual of inner contemplation, which is very similar to the method taught by the Quietists, the first section is, do not read this book unless you have been given permission. You know, like by the authorities. It is, you know, dangerous to follow this method if you are not prepared. And what they mean prepared is, you know, like that you're taking the sacraments and you pass the test of form. You know, like, and Madame Guyon goes, just, no, it's not dangerous. Just do it. You know, just sit in solitude. Anyone can do it. You know, like it doesn't require, you don't need paraphernalia, you don't need this. This, that, and the other, and she explicitly says that it's available to the uneducated equally. You know, like, I think that the quietists have a lot to offer us. You know, like, I think they could go a long way to healing certain aspects of our culture. So, I find them very inspiring, and I hope you've enjoyed my little introduction to the quietist of Buddhism. Thank you very much.
Thank you.